Hi, I'm Paul Havershood, host of The Cost of Living. It's a show about money and how it shapes our lives. In big ways, like why inflation could get worse if we all make more money.
Here's the hard truth in all of this. Workers are going to have to eat that real wage loss.
And small ways, like what's the fastest way to order fast food?
That first Big Mac that comes out of the kitchen is going to the drive-thru.
Check out The Cost of Living. We're on CBC Listen or wherever you get podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens, the podcast edition. Tonight.
Going through the motion, NDP Foreign Affairs critic Heather McPherson tells us why she sees last night's vote on her Middle East peace motion as a win, despite the Liberal Party's considerable amendments.
Still feeling blown away. Several weeks after an Alaska Airlines flight lost a door in midair, we'll hear from a passenger who's now a plaintiff in a new lawsuit demanding accountability.
Over a barrel, Ukraine finds a way to target oil refineries deep inside Russia. A security expert in Kyiv says it could be a winning strategy.
Exposing a cover-up. A Louisiana art collector tells us about becoming obsessed with a 19th century painting after seeing two images of it online, one depicting an enslaved teenager and one where he'd been painted over.
Sticking themselves where the sun don't shine, as next month's total solar eclipse grows ever closer, Niagara Falls is preparing for a turnout of tourists the city's mayor predicts will eclipse all previous records.
And cooler heads really have prevailed. Beluga whales have masses in their foreheads called melons, and scientists have discovered their melons change size when they're courting or cussing at each other. As it happens, the Tuesday edition, radio that learns you can say honey don't with a head like a honeydew. An immediate ceasefire, continued funding to the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, or UNRWA, unimpeded humanitarian access to Gaza, and a negotiated two-state solution. All measures called for in an NDP-sponsored motion pertaining to Canada's actions to promote peace in the Middle East, and all measures Canada's Liberal government had already endorsed.
Yesterday, for me, was the day I was very proud to be a parliamentarian. In this House, we came together, four to five parties, to find a workable solution, to find a Canadian position that Canadians could be comfortable with. We will continue to advocate for a ceasefire. We will continue to not sell arms, as we have promised, and continue to make sure that we bring hostages back to where they belong, in their homes.
Liberal MP Rob Oliphant voicing his support for an NDP motion on peace in the Middle East in question period today. The motion passed late last night with considerable amendments and despite considerable opposition from the Conservative Party and three members of the Liberal Party caucus. NDP Foreign Affairs critic Heather McPherson was its sponsor. We reached her in Ottawa.
Heather McPherson, as you heard there, Rob Oliphant is proud, he says, of the motion that passed yesterday, but it is quite different than the motion you initially tabled. Are you proud of it?
You know, I am. I'm proud that yesterday in the House of Commons, we had for the very first time ever a debate on what Canada can do to build peace in the Middle East for Israel and Palestine. You know, we had a debate about Palestinian human rights and the recognition of Palestine as a state. So even just the debate is this incredible moment. But even more so, you know, our motion that we brought forward had 9 items on it. And I wrote that motion with the help of legal experts. I wrote that motion with community members. I wrote that motion, you know, speaking to people with firsthand knowledge of what was happening in Gaza. And we did that because we wanted it to pass. We wanted to be able, this was never supposed to be a motion that would divide. It was always supposed to be a way that the Canadian Parliament could actually recognize Palestinians and recognize that there is a potential genocide happening right now, and every Canadian should be doing everything we can to stop that.
Your original motion called on Canada, as you said, to recognize the state of Palestine. The motion passed last night calls on the government to, quote, work with international partners to actively pursue the goal of a comprehensive, just and lasting peace in the Middle East, including towards the establishment of the state of Palestine as part of a negotiated two-state solution, unquote. The Liberals, as you well know, had already expressed their commitment to a two-state solution. They've done that repeatedly. What does this change?
Yeah, so, you know, we worked with members of the community. We worked with legal experts. As we were doing negotiations with the Liberals, we were constantly checking in with Palestinian Canadians, with Jewish Canadians, with human rights experts, you know, nonstop. And it was very clear from the community that the conversation on Palestinian statehood was important, but that it could take place in the coming weeks. But right now, as a potential genocide is happening, as children are starving to death in Gaza, it was those eight other pieces that we had to get agreement on. We had to be able to pass something within the Parliament of Canada that recognizes the gravity of the situation that the Palestinian people are facing right now.
But as Minister Joly said yesterday, a motion cannot change Canada's foreign policy. And a lot of what ended up in what was agreed on are things that they're doing. On the issue, you called for sanctions on Israeli officials who, quote, incite genocide, unquote. That was amended to say a call for Canada to sanction extremist settlers in the West Bank. On February 3rd, as you know, Minister Joly announced sanctions against four extremist settlers in particular accused of acts of violence in the West Bank. So was this just to show Canadians that you care and that your party cares?
So the first thing I would say is that in terms of Canadians knowing that the New Democrats care, I mean, the first time I called for a ceasefire was October 11th. And frankly, it has been through the pressure of communities across this country, of Canadians and of the NDP that has actually put pressure on the government to do some of these things. You know, even this is a bit of a unique situation because this Oppo Day came out and then we had 2 weeks before we debated it. And during that time, you know, the government decided to reinstate funding for UNRWA because they had this motion and they knew they were going to have to defend this in the House of Commons. So they moved on that. You know, Melanie Joly said that she was going to pause arms sales to Israel. Well, that's not true. And we really couldn't trust her at her word because we know that since October 7th, that Canada has sent millions of dollars of military goods to Israel. Mm-hmm. So we needed to make sure that language, that both potential future exports authorizations, as well as those that have already been approved, would be included. You know, I'm not gonna pretend I wouldn't have preferred our motion. Mm-hmm. I think if Canada truly believes in a two-state solution, you have to recognize that there are two states. So we're going to keep pushing on that.
There was significant opposition to your motion, as you know, including from Liberal MP Anthony Housefather, who said it creates, quote, a false equivalency between the state of Israel and the terrorist organization of Hamas, unquote. What is your response to that argument?
I think that's absolutely untrue. I mean, right now, as we sit and speak to each other, people are starving to death in Gaza, people that have nothing to do with Hamas. There are 13,000 children who have been killed. They have nothing to do with Hamas. You can't tell me that babies born in hospitals deserve to die because Hamas attacked Israel. Hamas is a terrorist organization. You know, one of the things that the Liberals tried to soften and we wouldn't let them is respect for the ICJ and the ICC, because we want the ICC to hold Hamas responsible for what's been done. But the trauma that is also being felt by the Palestinian people needs to be acknowledged. And there are things that we can do as a country to alleviate that suffering now.
NDP leader Jagmeet Singh, as you know, has said and wrote online on social media that your party has, quote, forced the Liberals to stop selling arms to the Israeli government, support the ICC and the ICJ, place sanctions on extremist settlers and much more, end quote. But the use of that word force, you know that this motion doesn't force the Liberals to do anything. It's non-binding. And I wonder if you feel that kind of hyperbole is helpful.
So here's the thing. All opposition days are non-binding. That's just the way our parliamentary system works. So, of course, we're aware that this is a non-binding motion. However, yesterday, the Prime Minister of this country and the Foreign Affairs Minister of this country stood in this House and agreed to those 8 points that we brought forward, including stopping the sale of arms to Israel, And so that gives us the ability to hold them to account. You know, parliamentarians.
But are you worried that when the leader of your party uses a word like forced in this context, that it just muddies the waters and actually takes away from what you were trying to achieve?
No, I feel like every day going to the House and I try to force the Liberals to do the right thing over and over again. I don't think it's hyperbole. Even getting to where we got on this negotiation, the desire to water down the language, to soften, to weaken this motion was really present. And for me, the fact that we were able to get these 8 pieces that will help people in Palestine and help alleviate some of the suffering we're feeling in our communities right now is important. I think it's an important day. I think the fact that we had the debate at all is important.
Heather McPherson, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Heather McPherson is the foreign affairs critic for the NDP. She's in Ottawa. Deep within Russia, there's increasing worry about buzzing objects that appear out of nowhere and inflict massive damage. In the past weeks, Ukrainian drones have hit oil refineries far from the fighting, sending smoke and flames billowing into the sky. According to one estimate, the attacks have disabled 10 to 15% of the country's refining capacity. But it remains to be seen whether the drone strikes will have any measurable impact on the war. Maria Avdiva is a Ukrainian security expert. We reached her in Kyiv.
Maria, we know Ukraine has been using drones throughout this war, but how has the technology evolved so it is at a point where it can hit targets hundreds of kilometers inside Russia?
Well, these are mostly private productions, and these drones are of different type. And Ukrainian production has developed greatly. So at the beginning of the invasion, Ukraine started with small FPV drones that you can freely buy on the market, or Mavic drones. Now these types of drones that are used to strike deep inside Russia are very specifically developed for that. Mm-hmm. And this is like a boom in drone technology production, allowing Ukraine to like invent new technologies that will allow drones to fly further, because sometimes the targets are as far as 500 miles inside Russian territory.
Many of these latest attacks were launched as Russians voted in the presidential elections there. What do you think the message is that Ukraine is trying to send?
So Ukraine is showing that the targets, the refineries inside Russia are legitimate targets, and Russia is not having enough air defense to stop Ukrainian drones, and that Ukraine will continue because Ukraine wants to disrupt Russian logistics and oil refineries and everything mm-hmm. that fuels Russian war machine.
Could these attacks on oil refineries and similar sorts of targets actually make a difference in this war, or do you think these are symbolic victories?
No, they of course have a like specific meaning because at first we were counting on sanctions, that sanctions will allow to impact Russian economy, but they are not working as it was supposed to. So for now, drones are very effective mm-hmm. Because at some estimates, the number of oil refineries they actually hit was 10% of all oil production, oil refinery production in Russia, which means this is a specific burden on Russian economy, and this means that Russia will not be able to put as much money into the war as they can. Mm-hmm. And also every refinery hit means that Russia will have shortages of fuel. And this means that they will not be able to supply as fast and as many weapons and everything to the front lines here in Ukraine.
Ukraine's commander in chief has said that Russia's army is, quote, numerically superior, but that these drones are giving them the tactical advantage they need. Do you think that this advantage can really shift the outcome of this war?
Well, for sure, Ukraine needs like more weapons, not only drones, but long-range missiles. Ukraine is asking our Western allies for. But these drone attacks, they show that Ukraine can overcome Russian air defense, Russian German systems, and Russia is not feeling safe anywhere inside Russia as well. So this means that Russia will need either to defend more, that means to spend more on air defense, and this will distract their resources from the front lines, or they will have to relocate everything which is important deeper, which also makes it harder for Russia to use these types of fuel supply or of weapons depots for the war in Ukraine. So this all is very much helpful, but it is, I think, not like the only thing that then can change the course of the war.
What's your sense of how the Russian population will react if Ukraine continues on this path with these kinds of drone attacks on places like oil refineries?
So by striking these targets deep inside Russia, Ukraine is also showing Russians that war is not somewhere far away, that it is much closer, and it will get closer to Russian homes inside Russia. And Russians should see that if they do not react, or they are neutral, or they do not protest against the war will get closer and closer to their homes. So this will urge them possibly to somehow react and do something to stop the war.
When you talk about getting closer and closer and Russian homes, the attacks so far have targeted infrastructure. Are you saying that we're going to see drone attacks potentially cause civilian casualties in Russia?
No, I don't think so. Ukraine never is like hitting or targeting civilian targets inside Russia. By saying that this will move closer, it means that one thing is when you are somewhere in Rostov on Don watching Russian propaganda channels showing you how Russians are killing Ukrainians inside Russia. And the other thing is you look out of your window and see a Ukrainian drone hitting an oil refinery somewhere nearby. So that's a completely different story. And then probably this will make Russians realize that if they don't stop the war, it will at some stage move to Russian territory as well. So there is something that they should need to do to stop Putin and his regime.
Maria, thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Maria Avdiyeva is a Ukrainian security expert. We reached her in Kyiv. It's still weeks away, but a lot of people are preparing to turn their eyes to the skies on April 8th, when a solar eclipse will be seen in Mexico, the United States, and Canada. In some areas, the moon will block the sun entirely, allowing a glimpse of a total solar eclipse. It is a rare deal, and therefore a big deal. As we heard on the program this month, scientists are getting ready to see how animals react to the event. A lot of schools are closing for the day. People are scrambling to get themselves a pair of eclipse glasses. And stargazers are packing their bags to get the best view possible. Many of them are heading to the honeymoon and blocked sun capital of Canada, Niagara Falls. The city is in what is called the Path of Totality, which isn't as scary as it sounds. And National Geographic has already named it one of the best places to get a view of the phenomenon. Jim Diodati is the mayor of Niagara Falls. We reached him there.
Mayor, how are you planning to spend the day on April 8th?
Well, my plan is I'm going to ride my bike down to the falls that day so I don't have to worry about travel. And I'm going to have a backpack filled with everything for the day. So I'll have water and cereal bars and extra battery packs for my cell phone and anything I can think of. And, of course, my ISO-certified eclipse glasses.
So the most important thing.
And I'm telling everybody, bring your glasses. Yes, we're going to have some, but don't take a chance because we might not have enough. Order them. You can order them online. A lot of them are made right here in Canada. And if you really want to experience this the right way, bring your glasses with you.
On a good day, there can be a lot of traffic, a slow crawl alongside the falls. So are you encouraging people to walk and take their bicycles as you say you are going to?
I am. I'm suggesting make things as easy as possible and really plan in advance. You know, the old measure twice, cut once. And I'm telling people, don't wake up the morning of and figure you're just going to shoot down and get some gas while you're here and go take it all in, because you're going to be disappointed. The numbers we're anticipating are significantly more than we've ever had in the history of Niagara Falls. We're told by a major Emmy Award-winning U.S. documentary company to expect 8 to 9 times the biggest crowd we've ever had, and that would have been 2012 with Nick Wallenda, when we had 130,000 to 150,000 people. So if those numbers hold true, we could have 1 million people at one time in the city. We're definitely not built for those kind of numbers at one time.
How are you preparing for that?
Well, that's a great question. There's two aspects, Neil. One is safety, and we've got our Emergency Operations Center, our EOC, with police, ambulance, fire, and all levels, Niagara Parks Police, Niagara Regional Police, OPP, and we're preparing to make sure that we've got emergency personnel in all places, because it won't be easy to get them there after the fact. And on the other end, we've got our entertainment side. We want people to have a good, positive experience, educational, entertaining, and we've got the Glorious Sons, we've got the Niagara Symphony Orchestra, who will perform during the actual eclipse with some appropriate music, and we've learned from New Year's Eve that right after the midnight fireworks, we've got crowds beelining to their cars, and then we have gridlock. And to avoid that, we'll have entertainment that'll be gradual, hopefully.
You want to have staggered events.
You got it. Staggered events.
I heard you also wanted, you tried, but couldn't get Bonnie Tyler, Total Eclipse of the Heart. I mean, it's a natural ask.
Right? I thought so. And but she's going to be in Europe and unavailable. But now that we've got Glorious Sons, I'm just as excited that their name is so appropriate for what's happening. And, you know, I point out the uniqueness of this event. For Niagara Falls, the last one was 99 years ago. The next one will be 120 years. Unlikely any of us will see another one. And it's a once-in-a-lifetime event, and it's in a real unique place. Even National Geographic has said it's the best place in the world to be.
Well, when you heard or read that National Geographic said that, do you get excited as a mayor or a little bit worried?
It's a bit of both. And so on one hand, I'm really excited because we love doing things really, really big. But then I started to realize, wow, logistically, how are we going to do this? So we're doing everything within our power. I mean, bringing in extra washrooms and expanding parking areas and having travel plans and road closure events and working with the Metrolinx to add extra GO trains. But at the same time, we've never, ever dealt with something on this scale, a scale that's drawing in NASA and the Canadian Space Agency and the Guinness Book of World Records. It's going to be big. It's going to be record-breaking, and I'm excited and I'm nervous all at the same time. The weather has a big impact. We're within a day's drive of almost half the population of North America, and the rubber tire market is very strong, where a lot of people get up in a morning and the weather looks good, they jump in the van and they drive here, and that is very much a factor with the weather. So that day, I mean, it could be a day where it's snowing in April. It could be a sunny, warm day. We don't know. But I can tell you it has a direct impact on the number of people that plan to come to Niagara Falls.
That makes it even harder to prepare.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, our eyes are closed and we're shooting in the dark and we're hoping not to hit anything. We don't really know what to expect. It's never happened before. We can only look at, you know, success leaves clues, and we've had bad events happen in the past where we've learned lots of things, some the hard way and some not. And we're trying to think of what could go wrong, and we're trying to prepare for that.
Can the hotels handle that many people?
No, we don't have enough inventory for that amount of people all at the same time. Yeah. I can tell you the vacation rental market is on fire. I know people that are having people park their RV in their driveway. They're going to let people put tents in the backyard. They're renting out part of their house. They're having family come down and spend the weekend with them. I don't even know exactly what to expect, but I'm thinking Woodstock. I'm thinking of these big events to try to figure out how we're going to handle this. You know, we've even had to bring in extra cellular towers, and they call them cows, because there's not enough bandwidth for the amount of people that'll be using their cells. So we've got to have plan B, plan C, plan D. So we're trying to prepare for everything. As it is, we compete with the U.S. signals along the border. Now it'll be bandwidth. We'll be competing with each other. So we want to make sure that we've thought of everything. And even then, we probably won't.
Mayor Diodati, thanks for your time.
Neil, thanks for having me.
Jim Diodati is the mayor of Niagara Falls, Ontario.
Baby beluga in the deep blue sea, swim so wild and you swim so free. Heaven above and the sea below, and a little white whale on the go.
It's a sad moment when we realize we will never hug a beluga. We understand why not. Of course, it's a widely held belief among marine biologists that belugas would really hate it if a strange human hugged them. And every marine biologist I've emailed over the years agrees. So we accept it, but it's not easy. For one thing, they sound like this. Unless they want to sound like this. Adorable. But of course, if a beluga looked like a goblin shark, we wouldn't want to hug it. The truth is, belugas are cute. And unlike their relatives, the narwhals, they don't need ostentatious nose jewelry to make an impression. Belugas are humble. They don't have big heads. I mean, literally, they have absolutely massive heads. They also have melons. That's what scientists call the round, protruding forehead made of fatty tissue. And a new study finds that the melon gets bigger and smaller, from cantaloupe to watermelon and back, during interactions with other belugas. Ordinarily, their heads are just smooth and perfect. But when they're courting or arguing, their melons get shorter or taller or pushed forward or wobble back and forth because they're shaking their gigantic, cute heads. We don't know what these changes mean or whether they're reflexive or intentional, but they seem to be trying to communicate with each other because, as the study notes, melon shapes occurring during social interactions were performed within the line of sight of a recipient 93.6% of the time. It's fascinating stuff, but clearly more research is needed. And scientists, if you need someone to gently hold the belugas, just let us all know.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart McLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share two hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
The passengers on Alaska Airlines Flight 1282 are still waiting for more answers, and some are looking for something more substantial as well. 7 passengers on that flight are suing Alaska Airlines, Boeing, and manufacturer Spirit AeroSystems, seeking an unspecified amount in damages. The plane made an emergency landing in January after a door plug blew off mid-flight, leaving a gaping hole in the side of the plane. A preliminary investigation by U.S. regulators found that 4 critical bolts were missing from the flight. Huey Tran is one of the plaintiffs in the new lawsuit. We reached him in Garden Grove, California.
Huey, how often are you thinking about what happened on that flight? It's been 2.5 months now.
I wouldn't be surprised if I'm thinking about it every day, if it's not just from my own recollection, but also because the people I was with on the plane were very close to me. So, you know, we're talking every day in a group chat, mm-hmm. and talking about it and talking about the news coming out regarding the incidents or similar incidences.
And when you're not talking about it on that chat group, how do the memories come to you?
It'll be sporadic throughout the day, that especially if I'm meeting somebody or talking to my family, mm-hmm. Just to be reminded of how close it was. I literally thought I was going to die when I saw that, how big of a hole it was. When a life or death experience like that happens to you, you kind of have that reevaluation, mm-hmm. you know, rethinking about your life and what you're doing and your goals and what's important to you. And that horrific experience is still lingering today.
How has it changed you?
I would say I'm trying my best to spend more time with my loved ones. Trying to make more excuses mm-hmm. to stop by my mom's house to see her, mm-hmm. Things like that.
Well, as much as you're comfortable recounting it, and I know you and others are having these kinds of conversations and doing these interviews to talk about the litigation that's out there and what you want to happen next. But as much as you're comfortable, just take us back to that moment, because you had just drifted off. You were going to sleep, and then you realized something was wrong. What happened?
Correct. I was just leaning back, resting my eyes, as everybody does once you get settled in while the airplane's about to take off. I had just closed my eyes when I heard a swooshing noise of something, you know, flying away. So I immediately opened my eyes, and there was already a giant hole in the plane. I was a little bit dazed from opening my eyes. Wasn't really sure if this was really happening. It was definitely a bit of confusion and astonishment, and that quickly faded away to realize that there's a hole that extends from all the way to the top of the cabin to the floor.
And you're just one row away from it.
I'm just one row away from it, but I'm also in the middle seat, which the only other closer person would be cooling next to me. He's a foot away from it. I'm 2 feet away from it. I can literally reach my hand out into the hole. That's how close it was to me.
And are people like, what are you saying and doing in those terrifying moments? Are people screaming?
Because the wind noise was so loud, I could not hear anything else. I couldn't even hear Kung next to me. That's how loud the wind was.
Yeah, that's your friend.
So we had to communicate with hand gestures and facial expressions because it was so loud from the wind that we could not hear any announcements or anything. The only thing that I could hear was eventually a flight attendant on the back came up and came right up to my right ear and asked me really loudly if there was anybody in the seat next to the window. And at which case I shook my head and said no.
I'm speechless just hearing you describe it, because the idea that someone could have been sitting there.
Correct. And because of the state of shock, we had to even like kind of stop and try to remember and think, was there anybody in front of me when I was adjusting my seat and things like that. And then, you know, to recall that, there was nobody there. Yeah. By that point, I also saw the kid right in front of me. I mean, his shirt was completely gone. And his whole body was red after we got off the plane. And he said he had a laptop in front of him, and it was also gone. Like, it got sucked out of the plane.
Your friend as well, who you've mentioned, he lost his phone, shoes, and socks when they were sucked
Correct.
Off the plane.
Right. Yes. I didn't even know that he had lost his phone until a lot of people's phones were sucked out. And the only reason mine wasn't was because I had it in the net charging. So when I realized that my phone was there, I eventually pulled it out to try and see if I could get signal. I texted my girlfriend and told her I loved her, told her to tell my family that I loved them, hoping that even if we didn't have signal, that message would eventually come through when the phone got close enough to the ground. I also asked Kuhn, I told him to try and send a message out, and he started motioning that his phone was gone.
And he was injured.
Correct. When the pressure, when the door blew out, it was so strong, it pulled on that chair in front of him. And the legs of those chairs hit him in his shin. Both his shins were injured.
Mm. How is he now?
And well, it's been quite some time now, so he has recovered and he's able to move around now.
We know that there was a preliminary investigation into what happened. The National Transportation Safety Board, as you likely know, is planning a 2-day hearing, and the date for that is set for August. What are the questions you still want answered?
Well, I've seen a lot of information about missing bolts, missing inspections, not acting fast enough on the warnings that were present. I want to know who's going to take responsibility for this, because I've already heard Boeing and Alaska trying to say it's not their fault, and that just doesn't make any sense. I bought an Alaskan ticket and something happened on an Alaskan plane. Somebody is responsible for this, and I'd like them to get to the bottom of it and correct the issue so that it doesn't happen again. That very day, the thought that it was affecting my friends and family on board, and that it could affect other planes and other families. It could affect my extended family or my mom if she gets on a plane. This cannot happen to other people.
Huey, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Huey Tran was a passenger on Alaska Airlines Flight 1282. He's in Garden Grove, California. The CBC has reached out to Alaska Airlines, Boeing, and Spirit AeroSystems for comment. None of the companies have commented on the lawsuit yet. Just over a decade ago, Louisiana art collector Jeremy K. Simeon stumbled on an image of a painting online, and he couldn't get it out of his head. It was a 19th century portrait depicting an enslaved teenager alongside the children of the family that enslaved him. That was already enough to inspire Mr. Simeon to search for the painting, but when his research turned up another image of it from the early 2000s, he was even more driven to track it down, because in that second image, the young black man had vanished from the painting altogether. Mr. Simeon managed to find the painting, and now Belizaire and the Frey Children is part of the permanent collection at New York's Metropolitan Museum of Art. We reached Jeremy K. Simeon in Baton Rouge.
Jeremy, what do you see when you look into Belizaire's eyes?
You know, I see a bright young boy. I do see a little bit of fragility, but I see really an exceptional young boy, a young man, I should say.
When you see those eyes staring back at you, hanging in a frame in the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, what message does that send you?
It sends a message that I think we're heading in the right direction and that corrective history matters.
It's certainly taken a long time, many years, to get to this point. As you were uncovering the story of this painting, what did you learn about Frey?
Well, I found out that he was a prominent member of New Orleans society, a banker, merchant, and really somebody who is held in high esteem in the eyes of the public.
And how did Belizaire come to be part of the Frey household?
So it was in 1828, Belizaire and his mother Sally were sold to Frey, sold to Frederick Frey, and his wife, Coralie.
And he was just 6 years old.
He was only 6 years old.
What would he have been doing in the household?
So because this is urban slavery, mm-hmm. he and his mother were likely domestic, so they would have been taking care of household needs as well as errands, not necessarily hard labor, but still forced servitude.
Describe for our listeners what we see in this painting, what this illustrates about the life and that what it doesn't.
Well, I think that a quick glance at the painting seems to show some sort of euphoric antebellum meaning pre-Civil War existence. One could even take away that all of the children in the painting are equals. But that's unfortunately not the case because Belizaire is enslaved, although he is the largest figure in the painting, which kind of adds to that art mystery.
Was it rare that an enslaved person would be depicted in a painting like this in that time period?
It is rare, but enslaved people are depicted in portraits of the time period. Mm-hmm. However, in the case of Belizaire, he is not depicted in a position of servitude. He's not holding a tray or a hat, and he's not lower than the other sitters. Mm-hmm. That is very unusual.
What do you think the artist, what were they trying to send a message at that time?
I think the artist must have seen some sort of undeniable humanity and felt obligated to capture and translate that in paint.
Ultimately, Bélisaire was painted over. What happened?
Well, at some point in time, likely in the 1880s, 1890s, racial tensions rose. Mm-hmm. This was after the Civil War. And I think it became uncomfortable, an uncomfortable reminder or even a threat to have a portrait of a boy of color in your household. And that could have been because they were afraid that people would ask questions, whether he was related, or it was just an uncomfortable subject, something they no longer wanted to remember.
Then the painting ends up sitting in a garage for decades. The family eventually gives it to the New Orleans Museum of Art, but it was never displayed there. Why not?
I think that is a very complicated issue, and I think we could conjecture or speculate why, but it is strange that it stayed in storage for 40-something years.
In an interview with the New York Times, that museum gave a number of reasons for why they didn't display the painting at the time. One of those reasons was that they didn't know enough about it. That, I know, is not the first time you've heard that kind of response from institutions. What do you hear when you hear those words?
I would accept what they say about that in 1972, 82, 92, 2002. However, when I contacted them in 2021, they still, in my opinion, did not treat this as a priority or express an interest to right or wrong. So I'll just leave that right there.
When did this become a passion for you, this painting in particular? Tracking it down, then unearthing all of the layers to the story it was telling.
Something caught a hold of me the first time I saw it in 2013, and it always stayed on my mind. And so I had to figure it out because it was so unusual. I saw one painting, an auction result, where Bélisaire was covered, and then I saw where he was uncovered. And I had to get to the bottom of that. So I think that was the moment the seed was planted.
What do you hope visitors take away from it?
I think I hope that visitors take away that wrongs can be corrected, and also that they remember that this painting is a physical reminder of erasure, of Black history, and the Black presence.
Well, Jeremy, I appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Jeremy K. Simeon is an art collector in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. That's where we reached him. More than 50 countries have imposed some kind of restriction on asbestos, and for good reason. It is a dangerous carcinogen. But until yesterday, asbestos faced no restrictions in the U.S. On Monday, the Environmental Protection Agency announced a new program that will ban the use and import of asbestos, to the relief of Linda Reinstein. She's the co-founder and president of the Asbestos Disease Awareness Organization. In 2006, her husband died after being diagnosed with pleural mesothelioma. She appreciates the EPA's announcement, but she says there's still more to be done. We reached Linda Reinstein in San Diego.
Does this feel, Linda, like a victory after all these years?
I have to say it's a mixed victory. Mm-hmm. It's a victory in the sense that EPA finally finished the 8 years of work to prioritize asbestos, and the Part 1 rule was well-received in the U.S. and around mm-hmm. the world. It raised tons of awareness and interest, but the tough part for me is it didn't go far enough and it increased confusion because the EPA's Part 1 quercetal rule, although a significant victory, only bans one fiber in six conditions of use and will ultimately be litigated because the companies don't like to be told what to do. And, I mean, obviously, asbestos has been known to cause suffering, disease, and death for 100 years, and the U.S. still hasn't been able to completely ban asbestos. The EPA tried in 1989, but state power and politics is so powerful, it was overturned in 1991.
Oh, let me ask you.
Here we go again.
Here we go again, as you said. What took so long and is still taking so long?
So that is the million-dollar question. What took so long? It's a David and Goliath battle. Industry, for those who have imported and used asbestos, they believe they can use it safely, which is nothing less than preposterous. There's been tons of document suppression, doubt that's created, misinformation. So it's the ultimate propaganda spin on trying to legitimize a toxic carcinogen. And it's worked. And I think the tough part is because asbestos is nearly invisible, people can't readily see it with their naked eye, see it, touch it, taste it, smell it. There isn't an easy test. And when you are exposed, if you develop disease, it takes 10 to 50 years. So I think that those issues have helped to make this the ultimate man-made disaster.
You've also called
people
it the ultimate.
Don't know.
People, you've also called it the ultimate white-collar crime.
Yeah, I do believe that these elements of the invisible fibers and long latency has created the ultimate white-collar crime.
As our listeners heard, this is personal for you and your family. Your husband was exposed to asbestos. How?
Alan and I were married late in life. We ran marathons and skied black diamonds, and all this time I never knew he'd been exposed to asbestos. And when early warning symptoms finally confirmed that he had mesothelioma, I was truly shocked. I thought our air, water, and soil were free of contaminants, and I was wrong. Alan fought a hard 3-year battle. He elected to have a radical surgery. He actually removed a left rib, took out his lungs, removed the pericardium around his heart, and surgically replaced his diaphragm, all for more time. And I share those details because these diseases are all preventable. So it's preposterous for industry to claim that they can use it safely and to promote asbestos use when you know the health impacts are so astoundingly horrible for people and their families.
I'm sorry for your loss, Linda.
Thank you.
You know, as you well know, Canada banned it in 2018, the UK 25 years ago. What needs to happen? What needs to change from where you stand to make a more definitive change and one that you would be happier about?
So for me right now, I want to recognize that this is a monumental first step for the U.S. to ban one fiber in six conditions of use, but it's clearly not enough. ADO has always had a dual-track strategy. Like, I have to work with both the EPA and Congress. Ultimately, as it was written yesterday, the two senators that have been championing the Alan Reinstein Ban Asbestos Now Act remain committed. So we are, with all of the awareness and I think support that people are seeing, they're starting to learn little by little that it's not a complete ban. I think it's going to power our work in Washington to move the R-Ban bill forward and get it to President Biden's desk. Everyone said at the EPA White House meeting, at the announcement meeting on Monday, they confirmed what I've known for 20 years. So we have all the facts and stats. We just need Congress to do their job and move this ban bill across to the president's desk.
In the meantime, if there are people who don't know that they might be exposed or in danger, what is your advice to them?
So if somebody has been exposed to asbestos, I always recommend they have a conversation with their physician. They should explain when, where, and how they were exposed, let the doctor document it, and make the appropriate medical recommendations. Not everyone exposed to asbestos is going to develop mesothelioma or another disease like my husband suffered from. But having honest conversations and learning about early warning symptoms would have helped our family. I never knew asbestos hadn't been banned when Alan was sick. when I was looking for treatment for Alan, that's how I found out all the dirty little secrets that went behind in the United States when they tried to ban asbestos and have it overturned. I felt incredibly ignorant, not knowing the early warning symptoms and what to do. So I'm hoping that through Alan's story and the hundreds of Alans that have come forward, that we can raise awareness, simplify what people need to do, and make it into a conversation, because it certainly isn't a thing of the past. No way, no how. And I know our family is going to fight even harder, and so are so many others.
Linda, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for sharing our story and work in the United States.
Linda Reinstein is the co-founder and president of Asbestos Disease Awareness Organization. We reached her in San Diego. It took a lot of courage for survivors of residential schools to tell their stories, so it makes sense for those testimonies to be held in a space that honors them. But the facility housing those documents at the National Center for Truth and Reconciliation was not that space. But a recent donation may fix that. The Winnipeg Foundation has donated $5 million, which will go toward a new building to house the records, documents, and testimonies of residential school survivors. But Raymond Frogner says the new building isn't the whole story. Mr. Frogner is the head of archives and the senior director of research at the center. We reached him in Winnipeg.
Raymond, what, apart from the fact that it's been temporary, what worried you about this facility?
Well, currently the NCTR is located in the old Chancellor's Building on the campus of the University of Manitoba. It's a 100-year-old building, and it the basement leaks in the spring. It is very small in comparison to the staff that we hold. We began in 2015 with a staff of 15. We're now over 60. And so we've actually expanded out across campus to various buildings on the University of Manitoba campus in order to accommodate our growing staff. But any kind of meeting requires some kind of a compromise location. Mm-hmm. We have a very small conference room that we can accommodate small meetings for. And although the NCTR holds over 1,000 pieces of art on the themes of Indigenous identity, we don't really actually have a gallery. So mm-hmm. we can't curate and show any of the materials that we hold.
Is it only a problem of infrastructure, or is it more than that?
Well, going forward, we'll continue to grow. But in addition to that, it's a very colonial structure. One of the goals of the NCTR is to try and decolonize this concept of the knowledge of residential schools, to share it in a way that is guided by principles of Indigenous culture, tradition, and law, which is a very difficult thing to do in a colonial building built to as the home of the Chancellor of the University from 100 years ago. So, you know, to build a safe space that's welcoming and accommodating for Indigenous peoples, it's not a good environment.
Apart from the testimonies that are housed there, there are also pieces of art, as we've mentioned, artifacts as well. Are there a few that you can tell us about that mean the most to you?
Well, I mean, of course, the medicine box by Luke Marston is by far and away our most valued piece. It's the spiritual embodiment of our center. But in addition to that, we do have a set of quilts by Alice Williams. Following Stephen Harper's formal apology, Alice Williams put out a notice to collect quilt patches that she put together in a series of quilts on the theme of reconciliation and residential school experience. They're very, very colorful and very, very beautiful. Of course, we also have over 30,000 photographs that document the lives of children at various mm-hmm. schools across the 20th century. So there's no limit to the amount of materials we have. Kolex from the north, star blankets from the prairies, mm-hmm. carvings from the west coast. It's quite limitless, actually.
So in the dream scenario with this funding, what kind of facility would you like to see built?
The facility would accommodate Indigenous culture and tradition for ideas about a meeting place, a place of sharing knowledge, accommodating, a place of encounter. And in addition to that, I think it would be appropriate to have some kind of a meeting, like a conference center, mm-hmm. based on a setting that isn't sort of the formal business like table in a square room, more of a roundhouse kind of, or longhouse theme. Of course, we'd like to have an appropriate gallery where we can display our materials, yeah. In a way that's sensitive and respectful. We would also, in addition to that, like to have an appropriate studio where survivors can come and share their truths and have them recorded, so that they remain in the hands of Indigenous peoples and not, for example, in the case of the independent assessment process, in the third party secretariat's hands and potentially destroyed in 2027.
Why would they be destroyed in 2027?
That was the Supreme Court ruling on mm-hmm. the IAP records. If the survivors did not contact the NCTR before that time, they would be destroyed in a kind of weird, twisted, negative billing. Mm.
For just going back to something you were saying earlier, you mentioned the gallery space. I was going to ask you about that, because as it stands now, this is not something that anyone can just walk in and view.
No.
These are archives, and there could be requests, yeah. certainly, I'm sure, for people who are doing research, but it's yeah. not a museum. It's not a gallery. So
no.
ultimately, do you hope to expand the work of the commission to something
absolutely.
Like that?
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. And one of the primary reasons for that is Indigenous practices of memory and knowledge go beyond text. Their materials, multimedia, wampum belts, carvings, places for ceremony. Those are the memories of communities and how they're perpetuated. So in those cases, in those examples, there is a greater space required. At the moment, if we do have researchers come to see our artwork, it's stored in sort of a preservation format and in what's called the art lab. So we have to make a special accommodation to take someone into a preservation room to view the art, which is very difficult and awkward.
How soon could the facility that you're envisioning and that others are hoping for, how soon could it be up and running?
I've heard rumors of 5 years, mm-hmm. Hopefully. Who knows if it could be done sooner. Last year, the land was donated to us in a formal ceremony from the U of M, where elders blessed the land and recognized it as the future home for the NCTR. We do have some plans, but I've been told 5 years.
Is it difficult to be patient after all these years?
It's. I mean, as long as it takes, I think it's as we continue to grow and the significance of the work we're doing remains. It's worth the wait, I would say.
Raymond, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Raymond Frogner is the head of archives and the senior director of research at the National Center for Truth and Reconciliation. We reached him in Winnipeg. I've been in the market for a new place to stay ever since we started renovating the As It Happened studio here. We're getting a kitchenette installed so I can make my famous empanadas during the show. But it's not a great place to sleep. It's so dusty I have to keep vacuuming my futon. So I've been looking for a decent rental online, and I just am not... Oh, wait a second. This looks promising. This place called Garden Lodge in central London. It's a great location. It features a Japanese-style sitting room, ornate 19th-century furniture from France and Austria, and a luscious, perfectly manicured green garden. And apparently a lot of cats lived there before, which is a good omen. I think I'll take it. It's going for 30 million British pounds, which is about $51 million Canadian. Oh, okay, I see. A human lived at Garden Lodge, too, and it was Freddie Mercury. Now it's on sale for the first time since he bought it in 1980, and apparently he transformed it into the palatial property it is today, showcasing his iconic bright Freddie Mercury style in every room. His close friend and former fiancée, Mary Austin, the current owner, says it's where he threw his extravagant parties, but it was also a tranquil escape for him and his cats. Well, at $51 million, it is roughly $51 million out of my price range. Guess we'll all have to go in on it together, unless... someone wants to pay $51 million for this futon covered in sawdust. You've been listening to the As It Happens podcast. Our show can be heard Monday to Friday on CBC Radio 1 after Your World Tonight.
And you can, of course, also listen to our show online at cbc.ca/AIH or on the CBC Listen app, or, of course, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.